The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Well, Julie and I have stepped into the Special Collections Gallery on the second floor of the Morris Library Building, where we're going to talk with Tim Murray, the head of Special Collections, and the curator of this collection, Alexander Johnston, a senior assistant librarian in Special Collections. Alex, you got to tell us, why are we having so many Shakespeare events on campus this year?
Well, that's because this year marks the 400th anniversary since Shakespeare passed away. And I guess it's kind of strange maybe to be commemorating his death, but it is a significant year. And so that's what has been bringing us all together. We had the first folio on tour from the Folger Shakespeare Library, which was on view in the Munich Museums. And alongside that, we have been doing this exhibit in Special Collections, Shakespeare Through the Ages, which charts all the many ways in which Shakespeare has been printed, reinterpreted, and received throughout all these years.
Tim, are all the things up in this gallery, are these all part of the university's Special Collections, or has some of it been borrowed?
These are all part of our Special Collections.
Wow.
And I think the one of the things that's kind of interesting about this exhibit is that the University of Delaware has had a very long tradition of scholarship in the area of Shakespeare and the Elizabethan era. And in addition, believe it or not, Shakespeare is one of our most heavily used collections, including the material that's in this exhibit, which Alex could probably speak to a little bit.
Yes, for instance, we have a very strong teaching program related to mostly the undergraduate classes, where students will come in for a session where they get to work with and look at primary sources related to their classes. We've had Shakespeare classes and classes about Elizabethan England and the time period that come in to see these objects, these artifacts. And it'll be both texts they're reading as well as things that are relevant to the period they're studying. But in addition to that, we've had some pretty intensive seminars that have come in. There was one seminar that spent pretty much the entire semester in Special Collections looking at the sources of Shakespeare's plays, trying to analyze how these texts from different English chronicles became the plays that we know now. Then there's been another one called Making Shakespeare, where they're actually looking at how was Shakespeare's legacy and status actually created over the years. So not just his plays, but how does our perception of them transform from a period in which plays are disposable popular entertainment to a period now where it's high art.
You've even got classic comic books here in this case, along with Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare.
Yes, in this case, what I've put together are some of the different ways in which Shakespeare has been presented for juvenile and child audiences. The earliest one is a copy of Lamb's Tales from 1816, a slightly later printing. This was a retelling of Shakespeare's stories that was recast in a language intended for children by the siblings Charles and Mary Lamb. In this edition, Charles only gets credit, even though Mary wrote most of the tales. In the later edition shown up there, both of them are credited, and they even note who actually wrote which story to give them their full due. Some of the more recent ones, as you mentioned, are the classics illustrated. This was yet another way in which Shakespeare was recast in a way to try to make him appealing to children. With varying degrees of success, one of the odd things I noted in here is that they use all of Shakespeare's actual dialogue as speech balloons. There's occasional panels that further the action, as you would in a comic book, but if someone's going to talk, it's Shakespeare talking. And this is maybe an interesting way to introduce this to a child, but it's kind of awkward in places. For instance, in the Hamlet comic book, the to be or not to be speech takes up an entire speech balloon, which even as an adult is kind of hard to read.
This is fascinating. I mean, Lamb's Tales, I remember Charles and Mary Lamb tried to use his language as much as they could, but then there were some words that even by the 18th century had fallen out and they needed to replace.
Yes, and then on the more extreme of that, one of the other books in here is a edition of The Winter's Tale from the Little Folk Shakespeare series. And in this case, they didn't even try to keep his text in there. They just keep the story, with pretty color illustrations, but the text itself is done in a rhyming scheme.
Rhyming schemes have been used for centuries, for millennium, to help people remember things. Yeah.
I think also as you look around the gallery, you'll see that there's material drawn from many different collections, and I think Alex has really done a great job at pulling material in from just a wide range of disciplines, and it's really reflective of our collection as a whole. Because if you look in here, there's not just material from Shakespeare and the Elizabethan era. There's material from our artist book collection, our history of printing collection, even some of our manuscript collections. And one thing we'll get to that's really kind of a fascinating collection is our literary forgery collection, and which is represented very well in this exhibit.
I actually thought that was fascinating, reading about that at the website, the different forgeries of Shakespeare.
Yes, we have a very good collection of forgeries in the library special collections overall.
In fact, I might be able to just provide some context to that. One of our major donors was a man named Frank Tober, who was a chemist with the DuPont Company. And Frank became very fascinated by printing techniques, and he got into the realm of forgeries with one particular 19th century forgery that the people that exposed it used scientific methodology to determine that it was a forgery. So they could look at the paper, they could look at the ink and say, this couldn't have been produced, you know, during the period they said the book was printed. So even the typefaces hadn't been used before a certain date. So Frank really expanded his collecting into all areas of literary forgery, and there's a significant area of his collection that focuses on Shakespeare, which is what Alex drew on for this exhibition.
So in this case over here, we have a series of books related to forgeries that were made by a man named William Henry Ireland in the late 18th century. William was a teenager. His father, Samuel Ireland, loved Shakespeare and loved to collect Shakespeare and was quite credulous about his collecting. So he, for instance, had things like Shakespeare's stool and Shakespeare's table, which, of course, there is no truth to that. But in any event, his father really, really yearned to have some sample of Shakespeare's own handwriting, a manuscript that he could call his own, which many of us would still like to have. There's only about 5 or 6 of them out there. But in this case, William worked as a clerk at a law firm in which they had a large surplus of old documents, old parchment, from about the same period that no one was really using. And so one day he took a printed facsimile of Shakespeare's actual signature and tried to forge that onto a piece of old paper. He said that he found this in a trunk full of old papers, old documents that the owner didn't want. He brought this signature to his father, who was ecstatic and believed that he actually had Shakespeare's signature. The other important detail here is that up until now, Samuel had been a very absent father. He treated William quite cruelly. He thought he was stupid and would never amount to anything. And this was the first time he'd ever really shown any attention and affection on his son. So unsurprisingly, his son went and found in quotation marks, more and more Shakespeare manuscripts, which got increasingly elaborate. There were letters to Anne Hathaway. There were letters from Queen Elizabeth. He found the manuscript of King Lear and a manuscript to a new Shakespeare play, Vortigern, which would later be performed. He also, and I have an image shown here of this document, he found a will in which Shakespeare gave his intellectual copyright, which did not exist at the time, to an ancestor of the Irelands in repayment for having saved Shakespeare from drowning in the river.
Folks, you understand, every time Alex said found, he made air quotes, because Mr. Ireland made all this stuff up?
Yes, they were all forgeries that he did by his own hand. And for a time, Samuel just displayed these things at his house. Many people who should have known better came to see the glories of Shakespeare. But when this started to unravel was when he had the idea to publish these in a bound volume so that more people could see all the great manuscripts he had found. At that point, scholars could look at these things and say, well, this doesn't actually look like any of the Shakespeare documents we have in existence, so this seems kind of fishy. And one of the other books here is a book that was published by, or written by, a man named Malone, who was one of the premier Shakespeare scholars of his day. And he tore apart the forgeries, comparing them to the real articles, and showing how not just the script, but the actual text was also ridiculously inaccurate. In many cases, Ireland had tried to imitate the earlier spelling and writing style of the Elizabethan era, but overdone it beyond belief so that anyone who reads these documents regularly would know that that's not how the Elizabethans actually wrote.
Didn't he publish his book like just days before the production of the play Vortigern, which had unintended consequences?
Yes, exactly 2 days before the premiere of Vortigern, this book comes out, which makes the premiere all the more of a debacle. The play was not very good either, so he was a laughingstock. But more importantly, it was Samuel who received all of the bad press because he was the one who was publishing these things and profiting off of them and presenting them to the public. William felt bad about this, and so he wrote a little pamphlet in which he was calling an authentic account, and he wrote how he made the manuscripts. He took full responsibility. Most people just took this and said, okay, we're done. His father, though, did not believe that. His father thought that William was too stupid to come up with this and was now trying to steal the spotlight. And so he went to his death convinced that he actually had the genuine article.
Not to belabor the fraud part, but you also have up here, I think, some examples of the Collier forgeries.
That's actually a more sinister forgery, too, because he was a scholar, and his forgeries affected, scholarship for quite a few generations.
So Collier was a major Shakespeare scholar, and to this day there is still some stuff that he produced that people do cite that is relevant. And so it's a challenge with him to separate that from the fabrications. What happened here is that he had a copy of the second printing of Shakespeare's collected works, which he claimed had period annotations by someone who had made corrections to the text, inserted additional stage directions, things that would change how you actually read Shakespeare's text, and it would have been a major scholarly source. He published extracts of this, and he eventually published a complete works of Shakespeare in which he incorporated the changes into the new text, but he tried as much as possible not to let anyone look at the actual book. He put it on deposit with his patron, and there it stayed until his patron died and donated all of his books to the British Museum. And that is when things start to unravel, because the experts at the British Museum look at this and they can say, well, this really isn't in the style of handwriting of the time. We've analyzed the ink, and this ink didn't exist then. It's 19th century ink. And another coup de grace was that they looked and saw that in places you could clearly see that there were penciled notes from the 19th century that had then been overwritten in ink, and this was all forged. They published several books excoriating him for this and documenting all the ways, and this was fraudulent. He refused to admit that he was wrong, though. He said that that was there when he bought the book, and eventually he just stopped talking about it. The strange thing, though, is that he still had a successful career as an academic afterwards, whereas if one of us were to do this, we would have to find a new job.
Well, I think this raises some of the things that, Tim, you were talking about earlier. I mean, the opportunity for graduate students and undergraduate students to come and look at what we have in the special collections, to do work with primary materials and look to see what the sources are and how different editions of Shakespeare have been built.
Yeah, well, I think Alex has some of the original sources in the exhibit here, so if we wander over to this part of the exhibit.
One of the things that many people may forget when they see or read a Shakespeare play is that he was not inventing this on his own. In fact, one of his great skills was that he could take existing stories, myths, histories, and recast them in ways that they were dramatically different from what had gone on before, and make something new of them. And so here we have a number of the books that served as source texts, and they're the actual, they're not the very books he used, the same copies, but they are the same editions of these books that he would have consulted when he was writing his plays. And if you look at these as a student or a scholar, you can get an idea of how is this play actually created, what source text did he have to work with, and also what misinformation did he have to work with. Many of the histories are partisan, and they kind of had to be because they were writing under an authoritarian regime. They can't really criticize the reigning monarch or her descendants. And in turn, if they're writing about someone such as King Richard III, who was an enemy of that ruling regime, they're not going to give him a fair and biased account because you can't really do that and get away with it. So if you look at these, you can see how much was Shakespeare actually maligning these people and how much was he just taking the sources he had. And so, for instance, there's three histories here, Hall's Chronicle, Fabian's Chronicle, Holinshed's Chronicle. These all give accounts of English history with varying degrees of accuracy. And they include, amongst other things, the source texts for the history plays that range from Richard II to Henry VI. but they also include some of the other tragedies. So, for instance, Macbeth is partially based upon Holinshed's Chronicle, in which the reign of Macbeth is presented as part of Scottish history. And that's a very interesting one, because if you read the stuff in Holinshed, you find out that there's a lot that goes on after what is the ending of the play. In the play Macbeth, Macbeth kills King Duncan, Duncan's sons flee, they then raise an army, Duncan's sons kill Macbeth, and one of Duncan's sons becomes king. What you find out if you read Holinshed is that the two sons kill each other in another civil war, and then another person, Fleance, the son of Macbeth's friend Banquo, who he murdered, later becomes king. And this is hinted at in the play because mm-hmm. they talk about how Fleance's sons will give rise to a line of kings that will reign on forevermore. But they don't really talk about how that happens in the play, possibly because they want to have a not entirely depressing ending and give you some stability. And so you can compare the two and see how does he actually work with this.
So what about some of Shakespeare's other sources? Did he, for example, delve into mythology and things like Ovid? And what about the Bible?
Certainly. Ovid was a favorite source of his. We don't have one of those in the gallery, but that it was a major one. He probably was familiar with some text of the Bible, as seen by the various allusions he uses. And he also looked a lot at contemporary and near-contemporary literature, too. So, for instance, we have a copy of Chaucer, as printed in 1598. And that was a writer from the 14th century, so he was already old by the time Shakespeare was working with him. And, in fact, in this copy of Chaucer, there's even a glossary of all the Middle English language words that were no longer sensible to a reader in the 1590s, so the language already changed a bit. But he used Chaucer as a source for at least two of his plays. There is Troilus and Cressida, and there is also The Two Noble Kinsmen, in which the knight's tale becomes the basis for a new play. As an example of contemporary literature, I have a copy of the works of Samuel Daniel, who wrote an epic poem about the civil wars between Richard and Henry. And we're pretty certain that Shakespeare was reading that. And in fact, he must have been reading this shortly after the book was first released in the 1590s, because the date of some of his Henry plays is around the exact same time as when the book came out.
One of the things we talked about before we started this formal tour of the gallery was how intellectual property was different back then. I mean, the Stationers Guild controlled everything, and a playwright like Shakespeare didn't want his stuff published. Ben Jonson, yeah, I want my stuff published, but a playwright didn't want his stuff out there.
Exactly. Copyright did not exist. The only thing close to that was the right to print a text, which is if you were a publisher, you could go to the Stationers Company, get the permission to print this text, and then if someone else printed it, you could bring charges against them. But as an author, you had no rights to it. That's also why Shakespeare could ransack, say, Holinshed, mm-hmm. or a contemporary living person like Daniel, because they couldn't do anything about that. And so that's also why a playwright had no incentive to put his works into print. Plays were performed at the theater. You made money by bringing in an audience. You couldn't really make much of a money off of printed plays. There was a small market for them, but not much. The books that were printed usually sold at a loss. And in turn, if you put your words out there, another theatrical troupe could take those, and then they could tweak your play and turn that into their play and take away from your profit line. And so this was a valuable commodity for them that they didn't want to put out there.
Well, I think this exhibit is also a good example, and special collections in general, about how even though we live in the age of the internet, where just about everything is available on the internet or in some other form of media, that our own faculty want students to really experience primary resources. So that if you look in this case with the various chronicles that Alex mentioned, this is the exact, students get very excited when they realize that this is the exact edition of the book that Shakespeare himself would have used. It's not just, you know, text that they're looking at on a Kindle. So it's you know, there's a tactility to it, and it's really, really very exciting. And, you know, as I said, we really encourage this material to be used. We're not, even though it's on display, we're not a museum. We want students to come in and use it, especially our undergraduate English students who make very extensive use of the collection.
I don't know why you're looking at Julia when you say that.
I'll be back.
Now, In addition to the manuscripts and books that you have all around the gallery, you have a fair number of illustrations.
We actually did an exhibit once many years ago called Classics Illustrated, Literary Works Reimagined, and it was an interesting way to see how successive generations have reinterpreted or even just illustrated the work of someone like Shakespeare. And, you know, as you say, if you look along the wall, Alex has included quite a few different illustrators and artists who have reinterpreted Shakespeare.
One of the fortunate things about this collection is that because of the breadth of the years found here, there's a lot of different artists and art forms that have been used to represent Shakespeare, ranging from early engravings. There's one on the wall that shows the famous actor David Garrick performing as Richard III, which is one of his signature roles. There's a case that has illustrated books using what was then a very new technology of color printing, in which they were using Shakespeare more as a way to sell the book because they're imitating an illuminated manuscript with the color printing and pairing that with quotations from Shakespeare. So Shakespeare becomes more of a way to get this on the market than something you buy it for. On the other end of the spectrum, we have a large collection of private press books in which they were trying to create books that were works of art themselves. Many of these had commissioned illustrations for them, showing a variety of different techniques. One of the very interesting ones is the set that was published by the Limited Editions Club between 1939 and 1940. This was a 40-volume set in which each play received its own volume, and they also commissioned a different artist for each play. So not only do you get to see illustrations of plays that usually don't receive attention, the lesser-known ones, but you also get to see a multitude of different design styles from many different countries. They pulled people from all over, mostly Europe and the Americas, but it was still quite broad. And I have framed proof prints of some of these on display and others from the bound volume on display.
At the website, talking about these special editions that people were selling, the website, you've got some images of salesmen's copies that were used in the 19th and 20th centuries for door-to-door salesmen.
Yes, these are three examples that date from the late 19th century. It was fairly common at this time that you would build what was essentially a dummy or a replica of the complete set, in which you show samples of the book. So there's selected pages. In this case, all three of these dummies are shown to advertise multi-volume sets of Shakespeare, between 14 and 20 volume sets. You don't want to bring that with you as a traveling salesman, so they instead make the thing that shows you what it looks like. There's binding samples, there's other pieces of it. And there's also a register in the back where you can write up potential subscribers, and then you would mail them the finished volume. I've read that many of these people were not really that well-liked. They were seen as kind of a nuisance in the same way that sales calls once were. And in the case of these, and it may just be because they survived because they weren't used much, but in the case of these, they actually did not record much in the way of actual sales. And in fact, one of these copies was not able to receive a single customer.
Do you have samples of Shakespeare being used to sell other products up here?
Yes, I do, right next to this case. A few oddities. One of these, called Shakespeare Boiled Down, is essentially a Cliff Notes of Shakespeare from 1893. It gives little summaries of all the plays. It says that it's a good thing to read if you want to brush up on Shakespeare before going to see a play again. But what it also is an advertising mechanism for the Singer Sewing Company, who manufactured and sold this and put an enormous number of ads in the back to tell you about all of their products. So you buy this looking for Shakespeare, and then you get to see a lot of sewing machines at the end. Another neat one is the Shakespearean Show Book, and that's not a mispronunciation. They used one of the various archaic versions of Shakespeare's names to make the book look more old-fashioned, I guess. But in this case, this book has a different selection of Shakespeare-related stuff printed in there, and it was sold to raise money for the Chelsea Hospital for Women, which was a hospital in England intended for women who couldn't afford their medical treatment. The book was manufactured in 1884, and the hospital was actually operational for 1871 until 1988, and the only reason it ceased operations was because it was subsumed into another hospital, which is still active. So this is a case where Shakespeare was used to raise money for a really major charitable cause, which has benefited people for over a century.
Now, I hate to ask you this because as the curator, Alex, I'm sure you'll say they're all your favorites, but is there one particular thing you like to show people?
Well, there's one that's fun just because of how strange it is. It's maybe not a favorite book because obviously things like the Second Folio are a lot more exciting, but the story behind this is pretty spectacular. This is a book written by a man named Philip Samuels who went under the pseudonym of Samuels Bacon. He believed that Francis Bacon wrote Shakespeare's plays, which is not an unusual thing. People have been making that claim for many, many years.
Oh, but he went much further than that.
That he did. He believed that he was the reincarnation of Francis Bacon. And beyond even that, he believed that Shakespeare or Bacon had been so, had such forethought that when he wrote his plays, he encoded messages that would allow you to realize, if you could decipher them, that all this was true. And that Samuels Bacon was going to do all these cool things in the 1920s. And so he writes this book, which includes his lengthy decoding of it. It reads like a more torturous version of Aleister Crowley. Unfortunately, we don't really have any other information about Philip Samuels, so there's no way to tell if he was having a fun joke or if he was completely insane.
One of our, I've mentioned how our collection is really broad-based, and one of our favorite collections is our Delaware collection. And if you think about it, Delaware doesn't really have a state library. State library functions in an administrative capacity. So we like to regard ourselves as maybe the state library of Delaware in terms of collecting. And we collect all aspects of Delaware. And Alex has put together an interesting case here of Delaware's connection with Shakespeare, which might be interesting.
One of the earlier objects on display here is a little pamphlet called The Legitimate Drama, which was a transcript of a lecture presented at the Shakespeare Club of Delaware College, that being one of the earlier names of the University of Delaware, presented by a man named G. Frank Gooley, who himself was from Wilmington. And he talked a lot about the practical values of Shakespeare and how you can become a better person by reading Shakespeare. Another one is a 19th century cabinet card that was used to advertise a week of Shakespeare performances. Don't have the exact date, late 19th century, but what's neat is that this was done at the Grand Opera House in Wilmington, which of course is still active as a theater. So it's neat to see the continuity here. Another one that is of particular local significance is a copy of Twelfth Night printed at the Press of Kells in 1916. This was actually printed just down the street from here. The building is still standing, though not the press, but this was at 318 South College Avenue. It's right at the intersection of South College and East Park Place. It's the building that looks kind of medievalish. It's one story. It now houses Maricos, ELI, and a handful of other groups. But at one time, this was where some craftsmen got together and tried to make their own private press, their own answer to the private press movement. They're especially inspired by Elbert Hubbard, who operated out of East Roar in Buffalo. And this was one of the books that was printed here. One other thing of local significance, though, is near the very front of the gallery, there is a plaster bust of Shakespeare. And for many, many years, we didn't really know much about the source of that. It sat in the back of special collections. But after doing some digging, it turns out that this bust was actually given to the college in 1916. It was given to what was then called the Woman's College, because at that time the university was separated by gender. And it was specifically part of celebrations of the tercentenary of Shakespeare, and it was in fact given by the honorary members of the class of 1918. So it's pretty interesting, I think, that we have this continuity here. 100 years ago, students, faculty, and staff were celebrating Shakespeare, and this little bust has been sitting here ever since.
Alex and Tim, thank you very much. And how long is this exhibit available to the public?
Through the end of the semester.
Through December of 2016. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.